One time, someone, a grandmother, brought her grandchild to Mahatma Gandhi for guidance. The grandmother said that her grandson was eating too much sugar and eating more than his fair share of sweets, and she wanted the Mahatma to give the boy some instruction, some guidance, tell him to stop eating so much sugar. And Mahatma Gandhi said to the grandmother, "Come back and see me in a week's time." And he didn't even speak to the boy. So the grandmother went away, and the next week she brought her grandson, and the Mahatma spoke to the grandson, gave him some instructions, and said, "Come back in a week's time and tell me how you get on." So a week later, the grandmother brought the boy back, and she was very pleased because he'd given up eating so much sugar and stopped eating everyone else's sweets, and she was really happy with the result. And she said to the Mahatma, "The thing I don't understand is, why was it that when I brought my grandson to you the first time, you didn't even speak to him? You said to come back in a week's time, and only then you actually spoke to him." And Mahatma Gandhi said, "Well, I myself eat too much sugar, and I was eating more than my fair share of sweets too. And so if I wanted to tell your grandson how he should stop doing that and how to do that, then I'd have to know myself if I could do it and how to do it. So that's why I asked you to come back in a week's time, so I could see how I would do in a week." And this is a lovely story because it shows us that even someone as great, as developed as Mahatma Gandhi wasn't developed in all areas. And in order to be able to give instructions on the things that people asked, he was speaking, he wanted to speak from his own experience, not to just give empty words. And this is very much in keeping with one of the teachings that the Buddha gave, in which he said that the most excellent person is the person who not only practices for their own good, for their own welfare, but encourages others to do so too. The Buddha said a person who doesn't practice for their own welfare or for the benefit of others is useless. Living a useless life, as useless as a piece of firewood that's smeared with dung in the middle and is burning on both ends. As useless as that. The Buddha said the next kind of person is the person who tells other people what to do, gives them lots of good advice, but doesn't do it themselves. They're not really speaking from their own experience. They're speaking from theory. The Buddha said even better than that person is the person who tries to put into practice the teaching that they've heard. And even if they don't go out and give others lessons, just the fact that they are practicing themselves, living according to the teachings, this will have tremendous benefit. They will be an influence with the people that they share their life with, just by the way that they conduct themselves. And then if they're asked to give help, guidance, training, then they will be able to speak from experience. And that's why the most excellent person is the person who is practicing themselves and using the experience they gain from that practice to share with others. Because when we practice and we have the aspiration to keep the five precepts, live a moral life, develop wholesome qualities like generosity and honesty, reliability, then we discover how difficult it is to always keep the five precepts, how difficult it is to be generous, how difficult it is always to be reliable. And it's in those difficulties, facing those challenges, that we learn. We learn about ourselves and we learn about what we need to develop in order to live up to our aspirations. And so even if we don't go out and give talks, just the fact that we are struggling in this way to develop the spiritual path, this will be of assistance to others. And coming together in this kind of situation, coming together with spiritual friends, one of the benefits of doing that is that we are able to share with each other the experiences we have through doing the practice. If we don't do the practice ourselves, then we don't know the difficulties. And this is particularly important if we're trying to make peace in the world. From a Buddhist perspective, we always start making peace, first of all, in our own heart, and use the peace that we're able to develop in our own heart to make peace with the people that we live with, and the people that we work with, and the people that we share our lives with. And we use our experience of trying to do that to help us understand how to go out into the world to make peace. We understand how to do it, and we understand how difficult it is. And this is very important, because unless we understand from our own experience the difficulties and challenges, then it is very easy for us to judge others and say that that person is terrible because they hate. And we can hate that person without realizing it. We think our hate is justified. Our hate is all right because we've got the right point of view. And that person who has a different point of view is wrong, and their hate is wrong. And we might say that person should give up their hate without asking, am I able to give up my hate? Am I able to see someone else's point of view? There's a nice story about the way we think it's all right to be angry ourselves. It's just a problem if someone else is angry with us. When two children were fighting, a little boy, 6, and a little girl, about 8, and their mother could hear them squabbling, and so she went to try and sort out what the problem was. And the little girl said, "Everything was peaceful until he hit me back." And this is very typical of the attitude we have. It's all right for me to be angry. It's all right for me to be aggressive because I'm right. It's not all right for you to be like that because you're wrong. And if we look around at the world today, when we see ourselves threatened with war, we can see this attitude from all sides. And we can see it in our own heart as we make one side right and another side wrong. One group, the aggressor, another group, the oppressed. And we don't notice that there's hate and anger on all sides, and even in our own heart. So the path of practice for Buddhists is to tune into that feeling within our own heart and to work with it. not to deny it, not to feel terrible because we haven't got peace or because we feel angry, but to deal with what is actually arising in our own heart. And if we start to investigate why is it that we get into situations of conflict, very often with the people who are closest to us, the people that we love, the people that we live with, we will see that even when we are living very closely with another person, that what brings us into conflict is a clash of self-interest. Each one of us is operating from a perspective of self-interest. And from the Buddhist teaching, there's nothing to be surprised about in that. Because the reason that we are born again, why we are back here, is because we have the desire to be here. In Pali, this is called bhava tanha. And it's this bhava tanha which propels us from life to life. And it's this bhava tanha, this desire to be, which is the driving force for all the things that we do in this life to try to protect ourselves, to try to support ourselves, to try to look after ourselves. And so it's no wonder that we come into conflict, because each one of us is operating with that as a driving force. And obviously we're going to find that what suits me and serves me is not always going to coincide with what suits others, what serves others. And this is how we come into conflict. And when conflict arises, there is the immediate knee-jerk reaction to try to protect ourselves, to try to maintain our position. And we get into all kinds of proliferation around that very basic action. And this is what gives rise to conflict between people and all the way up to conflict between countries, trying to preserve our own self-interest. And if we start to wake up to that in our ordinary daily relationships, that's a very big start to being able to make peace. Getting beyond that sense that I'm right. Getting beyond that sense that it shouldn't happen this way, this person shouldn't be this way, because it doesn't suit me. Once we can start to be aware of that, then we can start to ask ourselves, where does my true self-interest lie? In terms of the Buddha's teaching, the idea that we are independent and that we are existing independent of others in our own little world is not the truth. It's a misunderstanding. Whatever we do is going to produce effects. Effects within our own mind and effects on the people around us. And so when we are considering what's in my own interest, in Buddhism, we're not just looking at the short-term result. We are looking at what am I setting in motion, not just now, but for the future. What's going to come back to me as a result of what I'm doing now? And we start to see how our self-interest is connected to the self-interest of others. That we can't expect to produce what we want and get away without creating any new causes for the future. Causes which will give rise to new effects. So that means that as we start to consider what we're going to do in a particular situation, we think about not only the immediate result or immediate gain, but what is it going to have, what sort of lasting effect is it going to have on me and on my relationships. So, for example, someone was talking to me recently about how they handled their divorce. And they were telling me that initially when their husband walked out on them, that obviously there was a lot of anger and a lot of sadness and a lot of pain. Not only on the part of the person who'd been left by their partner, but by the children of that relationship. And not only by the children, but also the extended family. And as happens very often in that kind of situation where one person is perceived as the person who's wrong and everyone else is perceived as the victims of that person's bad behaviour, the family were saying, make him pay. And not only the extended family, the children were saying, he didn't just leave you, Mum, he left us as well. Get back at him. Do what you can. Make him pay. And what was the initial reaction was, yes, I'd like to. He should pay. But because this person had been practicing the Dharma and had been trying to develop a deeper understanding of life and relationships, she realized that that would be only very short-term benefit. And so she had as her overriding thought, at the end of this, I'm going to have to live with myself. Doesn't matter who else I'm living with, I'm always going to have to live with myself. And if I act with hatred, if I act with jealousy, if I act with greed, then that's what I'm going to produce in my own mind. The pain that goes with greed, with jealousy, with hatred. And whatever I do now is going to start the ball rolling for the future relationships. And so whenever the temptation arose to get back, do something nasty, make things more difficult, she reminded herself, no, at the end of this, I want to be able to live at peace with myself. And so she didn't follow the urgings of her children. She didn't follow the urgings of her extended family. She did what she had to do, but she did it without allowing her emotions of anger, hatred, resentment to be the determining factor in what she did. And the whole process took 5 years. So this was something she had to work with over and over again. And as the emotions subsided, things got a little bit easier. And then something else would happen, and so the whole thing would arise again. But because of her determination not to create more pain for herself or for those around her for the future, she persisted with her intention not to deliberately hurt her husband. And by doing that, by allowing things to take their course, acting when appropriate, doing what needed to be done, she was able to help the other people who'd been so hurt by what had happened to also find some peace with the situation. So instead of stirring up the kids, instead of using the hurt that she felt against her husband and against the children also, letting that hurt be a weapon that they could use, she actually helped them to find some peace, some reconciliation with their father. Now, this is a very skillful way of dealing, but it doesn't happen unless we have produced the conditions in our own mind to be able to relate in this way. And so we have to ask ourselves, how do I do that? What is the path of practice? How do I go about being able to deal with such an emotionally charged situation so skillfully? And the first part is that we have to start doing that in the easier situations. We have to start laying the foundations when it's not so difficult, when it's not a matter of life or death, my sanity, my livelihood. We have to start working on those small irritations where we think, I'm right and you're wrong, and my anger is justified and yours isn't. So we have to start tuning in to what's going on in our own heart, in our heart and in our relationships. Noticing when our self-interest gets threatened. Noticing what arises when our self-interest is threatened. Being aware of fear. This is going to hurt me. Fear of losing control. I can't let them get away with that. Fear of a dent in our self-image. I know. You should do what I say. All the reactions that come when we're challenged, and all the reactions which give rise to anger, ill will, aggression. Each one of us will have a different way of dealing with situations. Each one of us will have different reactions triggered within us. So we need to be able to observe with mindfulness to see what's happening, and to see not only what's happening but what happens next. If I'm able to notice that there's fear present, can I refrain from acting from that fear? What happens when I'm fearful? Usually I hit out. Or maybe I withdraw. What happens when fear's there? What situations make fear arise? How can I practice a different reaction? So it's not only being aware of what's going on in our own heart, but observing the effect of that on our speech and on our behaviour, and the effect of what we do next on our heart. So if I have fear and I act with aggression in order to protect myself, does that make the fear go away? Does that solve the problem? Does it help? What happens next? Now, we can start this kind of practice in a very small way. What do I do when a spider comes into the house? There's fear very often, things that might bite us, things that might hurt. And we can notice when we're not mindful, we might just automatically swat it, get rid of it. And then we notice when the next spider comes in. Same reaction of fear, same reaction of swatting it. Being fearful and protecting ourselves hasn't actually gotten rid of our fear. Hasn't helped to reduce the fear. The fear is still there, and every time we act on it, it actually makes it grow. So with something that we know that we have difficulty, how can we start to change our knee-jerk reaction? It might be that we don't like a particular person. And every time we see that particular person, we get an immediate reaction of aversion. Okay, if I allow that aversion to run on, and I think about all the reasons why I don't like that person and why I'm justified in not liking that person, does it make that aversion go away? Does it lead to peace of mind? Who does it harm? Does it harm me or does it harm them? So we investigate, and then we try small ways of changing our usual way of reacting. And as we investigate, and as we try to initiate changes, as I said at the beginning, we see how difficult it is. We see how hard it is to be at peace. And when we understand how hard it is for ourselves, we understand that's what it's like for everyone else. To really put into practice the teaching, to really make changes, to really forgive is not so easy. So we don't jump on other people expecting them to do what we ourselves are still struggling to do. And this is very important because it means that we change our attitude to the people who are causing us problems. And just changing our attitude, no longer having the knee-jerk reaction of hatred, already changes the situation. It may not solve the situation, but it changes the situation. It opens up the possibility of a more positive resolution. So from our side, we start to make peace. But it begins by being awake and aware to our own inner reactions. In terms of the guidelines for practice which the Buddha has given, apart from being mindful and observing what kind of life we're producing for ourselves through our reactions, the Buddha talked about a thing called abhaya dana. And abhaya is the Pali word for freedom from fear. And the Buddha said anyone who keeps the five precepts makes an offering to the world of freedom from fear, abhaya dana. Because the first of the five precepts is that I undertake the way of training to refrain from harming living beings. Now, understanding this is the way of training. It's not that we are saying, I'm never ever going to hurt anything else again, because that's too big an ask. What we are doing is we are committing ourselves to train towards harmlessness. And all the other precepts fall under the umbrella of harmlessness. And as we reflect on this precept, we understand that it includes not harming ourselves. It's not a matter of putting ourselves in a situation where we are always stepped on, where we allow other people to do with us what they will. We're included in that trying to live harmlessly. But it means that we make the conscious, deliberate effort to practice harmlessness in our daily life, with the things that can hurt us and the things that can't hurt us. Sometimes we can find that we don't really take much care with the little things that we know can't sting us or bite us, or the things that we can get rid of by easily sweeping them aside. We don't even notice them very often. The things that might really hurt, that might really give us a bite, or the person who might really cause us some pain, those people we take a lot of care with, or those things we take much more notice of. So we start to broaden our awareness to include all beings, the little ones and the big ones, the ones that hurt us and the ones that can't hurt us. And we try to extend that feeling of harmlessness to everyone and everything. And of course that means that we have to keep on paying attention to what's going on in our own heart as we come into contact with those beings. Do we dismiss them because they're not a threat? Are we ruthless with them because they can't hurt us back? And notice these reactions, these ways of dealing with things in the world. And don't be surprised at this ruthlessness that operates in the world, between people, between companies, between nations. We see it in our own heart and we're not surprised. Now, we can't change what's happening between the world out there, but we can change what's happening between our heart and the world that we come in contact with, the people that we live our lives with. That's where we have to start peacemaking. And sometimes it means that we're going to have to not get what we want. We mightn't be able to bully our way through. We mightn't be able to get away with what we would have done before in order to achieve our results that we want, because now we've made a commitment to harmlessness. And when we live our life in this way, we create a particular kind of energy around us. The people who come in contact with us, and not just the people, the animals, any being that comes in contact with us, when we're cultivating this commitment to harmlessness, picks up that energy. And the energy that we give out affects that being that's coming in contact with us. It's one of the factors in the situation, in the interaction, and it has an effect on the quality of the interaction. So at the nuns' monastery, when people come to the nuns' monastery, even if they're not Buddhist, even if they're coming there not to offer dana, but to as tradespeople doing work around the place, they walk into an atmosphere of harmlessness. Because those who live there, those who come there regularly, are all cultivating harmlessness in their lives. And that creates a particular kind of energy. And when people come into that, they feel it. Recently we had someone, a tradesperson, came to the monastery and they had to come back a second time. And when they were talking about coming back a second time, they said, "Now, when I finish my job, I'd just love to sit out on the veranda for a little while after I finish and just have a cup of tea after I finish before I go away." And it was very interesting to notice that when these two tradespeople came as a team, and when they first arrived, they'd never been to a monastery before. It happened to be the moon day, so we'd shaved our heads freshly, and I guess we looked a little bit peculiar to what they were used to. So when they first arrived, they were a little bit sus, you know, but we don't know really what's going to go on here. So they were, you know, just watching. And by the end of the first day, they'd relaxed considerably. And then when they had to come back next week, when they were finishing their job and coming to sit on the veranda, the tradesperson said, "You know, I've been looking forward to this all week, just coming to sit on this veranda here." And, you know, no connection with Buddhism, no idea of what we were about, but interested once they came to find out what it is that we're doing there. And were full of questions. Interestingly enough, when they first came, that one of them wouldn't even have a drink of water because they must have wondered what the place was like. Now, another incident that happened just this week is that someone who was very distressed and very agitated and confused literally came out of the bush and landed on our veranda. And this person was in a very agitated and hostile frame of mind, very confused. And again, coming into the atmosphere of the monastery and being dealt with by everyone there with great loving kindness and compassion, this person sat down on the veranda and was offered a drink, had a chat, and this was just before Dana, and people started to arrive, the cars started to come. They thought it was the police coming to pick them up, and we had to assure them no, that wasn't the case. And we talked for a little bit longer, and just being in that atmosphere of harmlessness, that person calmed down and left much less agitated than when they'd arrived. They took off into the bush again. Now, this is a very powerful lesson. When someone comes into your space with that kind of mind state, then very often the reaction is fear. And what fear produces is aggression, protecting oneself, and not even knowing that it's fear, thinking that it's understandable. Anyone would feel this way. This person's got no business here. It was actually very, very a profound teaching to see how when someone in that kind of state comes into an atmosphere of loving kindness, even if you can't sort out their problems, even if they don't go away completely at ease, you don't make the situation worse by acting out of your own fear. And this is a simile which is given that when we act with aggression in a situation where there's fear, then it's like putting petrol onto a fire. Everything gets worse. We think that we're acting to protect ourselves, and this is the ironic part of it. Our self-interest wants to make sure we're okay, and then out of our self-interest we act with aggression and we produce an even worse situation. If we don't know what to do, if we can just receive that person without automatically reacting with aggression, then it's like allowing the fire to burn down without putting any new fuel on it. And this is what we encounter very often. We don't know what to do. We haven't got an immediate reaction. So this is when we go back to our own heart. We become in touch with our own experience. What's going on? Is it fear? Is it ego? Is it wanting to be on top? What's happening? And then we take a few slow breaths in and out to calm ourselves, to clear the head before we say or do anything. And at least we haven't added to the situation, added fuel to the fire. And if, once we've gained our composure, we can respond with loving kindness, with compassion, with harmlessness, then it's like putting water on the fire. Doesn't mean the fire is going to go out completely. Doesn't mean we're going to sort the situation out completely. It doesn't mean that we don't have to act. But it means that we're acting from a space which allows for more clarity of thinking, because our emotions are not so agitated. When the emotions calm down, there's much better chance of being able to think clearly. What's the best thing to do? Where does my true self-interest lie? To get to this point, one has to cultivate harmlessness in the easy situations, harmlessness with the things that aren't a real threat, and one has to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. And one has to develop the wisdom which understands that we are all connected. And whatever I do is going to produce an effect. And that effect is going to be a new factor in the situation. It might make things better, but it also might make things worse. So coming back to the understanding that we all are driven by our craving to be, to protect ourselves, to be safe. The more we practice this path, the more we see that our safety, our protection, cannot be gained through self-centeredness because of our connection with everything else in this world. We can't live in isolation. And if we're going to live in relationship with all the other people who are also motivated by self-interest, we'd better learn how to do that skillfully. So this brings us back to the original story, the story of Mahatma Gandhi, giving advice, giving teachings, only when he had tried it out himself. Through trying it out himself, he knew not only how to do it, but also the difficulties in doing it. And once he understood that, he could pass that teaching on to others. So I encourage all of you, as you face the uncertainties of the present time, and as you look at the differing opinions and factions and the differing people, that instead of adding the fuel of hatred to the whole equation, that you practice to add loving kindness and compassion, understanding that even the most powerful people in this world are just like you and me. And if we can't solve the problem, let's not add to it. So may this teaching be of benefit to you all, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. So the thing to I hope that you'll take away from here is that in trying to bring peace into the world, it's not a matter of just sitting back and doing nothing, but to try to do things understanding where peace has to start, and that's within our own heart.